pleasure to introduce Richard Haakley as our speaker this morning. Richard's Dharma name is Shinshi Tetsunen, Steadfast Resolve Penetrate Now Mind. Richard began his practice at Berkeley Zen Center in 1973 and received lay ordination in 1990. He was our Shuso in the year 2000 and received lay recognition, the Green Rakusu, in 2005. He's held many positions here, including for 7 years or so, he led the Wednesday night group welcoming many of us into practice at Berkeley Zen Center. He's been married to Joan for 44 years and has 2 grown daughters. We look forward to hearing what he has to say to us this morning. Richard.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning.
Well, the Bodhisattva ceremony we just had in this humid climate is causes a lot of moisture. I have ambivalent feelings about the Bodhisattva ceremony because it's so so much bowing. I sweat. I really need to wear my gym clothes to Bodhisattva ceremony. But my favorite parts are the first part. Oh, my tangled karma.
Ancient tangled karma.
Ancient. Goes back a long way. It does, too. Longer than I know. And the whole that whole part, you know, I talked to Sojin many years ago, sort of saying, well, Buddhism doesn't have confession. And he said, oh, yes, it does. There it is. And, of course, when you go to Dogasan, you also have an opportunity for some confession as well, if you want. But I think my very favorite part is is in the pre-pure precepts, the last one, which says, I vow to live and be lived for all beings. That be lived, just first time I heard it, just really caught me. And I've been thinking about it ever since. What does it mean to be lived? And it's really an interesting idea. And very, for me, very relaxing. I don't know if that's the right word. Relaxing and calming come to mind, but also kind of like I don't have to fight the world. I can just let the world and me beat and react in a positive way. And that's kind of getting ahead of my talk. But I didn't know we were going to have a Bodhisattva ceremony, so I just had to say that. Those are the parts that I love about it. Let's see. So, my practice is what I want to talk about today, and sort of a summary of practice, if you will, or a quick outline of practice. And I'm doing that because I think I am giving a lecture that I need to hear for me. And the reason I need to hear that is my practice has its ups and downs. And right now, I feel like I'm in kind of a down period. And what I'm looking for is some inspiration and some energy to bring my practice, enliven my practice, if you will, get it moving, and I was going to say a little kick in the butt. So I guess I'm going to give that to myself, which of course is where it always comes anyway. Some of you had a lot of practice experience, and a lot more than I have, and some of you have come for the first time. And for those of you who've come for the first time, or maybe the second or third, welcome. You're starting what I consider the great voyage of discovery. Greater than Columbus and Magellan. Voyaging to find your true self, which is much more important than finding America or circumnavigating the world or finding the Northwest Passage, finding your true self is where it's at. So it's really great that you've come, and that you continue that voyage, great voyage of discovery. So my practice history, as Andrea was saying, I'm not really sure it's 1973 when I started it. It's somewhere around in there. I was working as a computer programmer at Chevron, and this really cool guy with blonde curly hair came as a programmer, and I started meeting with him at lunch. We both brown bag lunches, And it turned out that he was a Zen student at the San Francisco Zen Center studying with Suzuki Roshi. Suzuki Roshi was alive at that time. So that must have been 69, 70, somewhere around in there. And we had many, many lunches where he would talk about Zen and I would listen. Previous to that, I'd been reading Krishnamurti, and some of you may be familiar with him. More of an Indian slant on spirituality and practice. I remember trying, after reading Krishnamurti, trying to meditate on the bus going over to San Francisco, where I worked, you know, the commuter bus. And I 10 seconds later, said, "Was that it? Was that it?" So I was pretty low on the learning curve there. But he talked about Zen, and I thought, well, that's really great, but I studied Krishnamurti, you know, so I had this sort of like, I was listening to him, but I wasn't really, hadn't really decided that Zen was going to be my practice. Turned out his name was Reb Anderson, and since became, as you know, or many of you know, one of the very early abbots of the San Francisco Zen Center, and is still a senior leader in the San Francisco Zen Center community. This is before he had his head shaved, but he was very articulate with Zen, even then. In a sense, I kind of figured he's my first teacher. So he left to go to Tassajara, and I stayed there programming computers, and went on vacation. My wife and I went backpacking, and I took this big, thick book called Three Pillars of Zen, which many of you may have read. Back in those days, there weren't too many Zen books. That was a pretty good one. And, you know, as a backpacker, you take something heavy like that, maybe it means you're kind of committed. So I read it on the trip and decided, okay, I'm going to go try this. And wound up at the Berkeley Zen Center, because I lived here in Berkeley. Wednesday afternoon, took Zazen instruction, had a really hard time sitting cross-legged. But eventually started sitting there at the Berkeley Zen Center on a consistent basis, where I would sit in the morning. We started practice at 5 o'clock in the morning in those days, and again in the evening. I would go both morning and evening. That was my enthusiasm, if you will. And I attended a few sesshins, and it's where I learned that sesshins were really hard, and it was really important for me not to move. And the fact that I wouldn't move when I was sitting, and the pain was there and the difficulty was there, helped me let go of my ego. So even today, if you hear me talk about sesshins and the pain of sesshins, I will say it's really important not to move, because for me at least, I've lived such a comfortable life my whole life. There really isn't any other place in my life where I really have experienced discomfort in such a way that I can't move or get away from it. All the other places in my life, I can always go somewhere else. But sitting sesshin, sitting cross-legged with the rest of the community, respecting them, part of this not moving is respecting your neighbors, because if you move, then they feel like they ought to move or want to move, and it kind of ripples. But that's really important. So I learned that. And then at work, I got promoted and sort of dropped off of coming to the Zen Center. This is when it was over in Dwight Way. But I continued to sit at home, two periods. I'd get up in the morning and sit two periods. I got promoted, and then I got demoted, which was a shock. So at that point, that was in the early 80s, at that point I decided I was going to go back to the Berkeley Zen Center. I'd also been paying my dues as a member of the Berkeley Zen Center for years. So I was still a member in good standing. Andrea was asking me earlier why it took so long for me to get my original Rakusu, my blue Rakusu, which was what, 1990, 1989, somewhere there. And I think that's the reason, because I had sort of a 10-year vacation or 15-year vacation where I had bought a house, got promoted, had children, got promoted, got demoted, you know, so the whole business of living my life. But I still continued to sit in the mornings. I still continued to occasionally read a book on Zen. And I always considered myself a Zen student, and I always knew I was going to come back here to the Berkeley Zen Center. So I had that kind of down period and then the up period. And then I've had, as Andrew said, lots of practice opportunities here. When I came back in the mid-80s, I resolved I was going to sit every sesshin for 5 years. So how committed I am to sessions. I still am. Sessions are wonderful. I don't quit quite so many each year, but I still think sessions are a great place to practice, especially multi-day sessions. I also went to Tassajara for 3 months, during the same 3 months that Sojin was down there in the early 90s, which was really nice. I enjoyed that. So recently, like in the last 8 months to a year, I found myself sort of slacking off my practice and not getting up and to come here, and really, in a sense, not sitting at home as often as I used to and as I'd like to. And so I said, what's going on? What's happening? And that's why I'm saying I'm wanting to review what practice is and how to practice it. Sometimes I'm afraid I'm a Zen tourist, although it's kind of hard to imagine I am, but sometimes I think that that's the case. You know, Zen tourist is someone who sort of comes in and looks at Zen and sort of plays it for a little while and then goes off, which is okay. There's many times people come and they leave and then they come back, as I did. So I think I'm always going to be sitting and I'm always going to be practicing, but I want my practice to be a little more intense than it is right now. Okay. So what is practice? Try to define it. Think of two ways of defining it, narrowly and broadly. Narrowly, think of Zen practice as being sitting meditation, most often here in the Zendo, sitting sesshins, and studying the Buddhist literature, all of which we do really well here at the Berkeley Zen Center. You can't come to a better place to practice in that way. And our leader, our teacher, of course, is a very good example of that. In the wider picture of practice, I can't believe I wrote this. I want to say it's meeting each moment of life with fresh response, not using habitual thoughts and feelings. I wrote that yesterday. This is 24/7 activity. Each day, each hour, each minute, being mindful and aware of internal and external activity, and then responding to that activity in a direct way that does not depend on old conditioned responses, but meets the situation correctly. I don't know if you understand what I said or not. We need Harry Potter in here to sort of handle this gobbledygook. He can translate it for us. Now, this is the wide definition. This is where we're meeting our life. You know, it's one thing to sit here in the Zen Center, which is really important. I sort of see this as the cradle of our practice, and we learn basically to meet ourselves. To meet our true self, and also to meet our ego. We learn that here, and then we take that out into the world, and because we've met it here, it's easier to see the responses in ourselves when we're out there, in the, what we call outside the gate, outside our little gate there. I go on to say, this is not easy. We don't often live up to this, and this ideal of 24/7 activity. And oftentimes we don't act correctly, as I can testify to many times each day. But then the practice continues to recover quickly and to return to mindfulness. Sojin has an example of a weighted clown, a little toy that's got a curved bottom, sand or some weight on it, and you knock it over, and because it's rounded, it comes back up again. And you rock it over, and it comes back up, rock it over, it comes back up. That's the way I understand him talking about it. That's basically what a Zen student is. The Zen student is knocked over with a problem, and they recover from that, and they come back to the center, to their mindfulness, to their practice. And even though we meet situations incorrectly, we probably oftentimes chastise ourselves or somehow wobble because of that, but then that wobble comes back. And it's the speed of that wobble coming back is sort of like is our mindfulness practice, if you will. It's recognizing that we need to put that away. Okay. So, how to practice. So those of you who've just taken Zazen instruction can already know this. Harry, I find that it's always good to review Zazen practice, Zazen instruction, because I need to be reminded of it a lot. So we can sit cross-legged, we can sit in a chair, we can sit in a kneeling position. When I first started practicing, I sat on a stool at home, a kitchen stool, put a pillow on it, and it was just the right height for me, and I could sit up straight and put my hands in the mudra position and sit. And then I would sit there for a while, and then I would go down and I would kneel and put a pillow under my legs and my fanny, between my legs and my fanny, and I would sit in a kneeling position. First I started with 5 minutes, and then I built that up. And when I get to 40 minutes sitting that way, that's when I went back to the Zen Center and started sitting there after having taken Zazen instruction and realizing I couldn't possibly sit in a cross-legged position. I don't know if that's the right way to do it, but that's the way I did it. Because I didn't want to be embarrassed. And chairs back in the 70s were not as plentiful as we have them today. Today, I don't know, maybe I never would have gotten to the cross-legged or the kneeling position if I'd had so many chairs as an opportunity, because I never would have had the motivation to do that. The thing that moved me from sitting in the kneeling position to doing the work to be able to sit cross-legged was that my back started hurting me so much in the kneeling position that I found if I sat cross-legged, my back didn't hurt. So that sort of moved me into the cross-legged position. Cross-legged position is great because you get the three-point triangle, right? You've got the one knee and the knee and the fanny, and you're really stable. So I like it. Okay, so we count our breaths, or we follow our breath. We put our attention down on the hara, and then we try to let our minds relax. I find that by counting my breaths, especially in the evening or in the afternoon when we're sitting zazen after a day, like I used to program computers, even today I still do it a little bit, my mind would be programming computers. And I would come in here to sit, right at home I'd sit, and my mind would still be programming computers. And so I saw the counting of breaths as kind of like a backfire, if you will. Sort of a way of telling my mind, okay, you don't have to program anymore, you can do something else, like just follow your breathing, just counting your breaths and that sort of thing. And it works most of the time. So when I was sitting very early on, when I was sitting in the stool at home, the kitchen stool, I had just had a little discussion with my sister. My sister and I have strained relations, which we've had she's 69 and I'm 60. I'll be 67. So it's been a long time. But she was a mile away from me now, so we have an opportunity to see each other frequently. And so I had this strange, this is back in 1970, call it 73. So I started sitting, or in a sense, on the stool, and my mind was just talking about my sister. And as I counted my breaths, suddenly I discovered that the whole issue with my sister had just fallen away. It was just gone. And it was amazing to me that that had happened. This is really early in my practice. And that, I think, plus the reading and the talking with Rev Anderson, gave me the faith that this was something that was really going to be really going to work for me. This Zen practice was something that was really going to work. And I think that it's that faith. That we have, that what we're going to be doing and what we're doing is really a true practice, it's also very beneficial. So those of you who've been sitting for years probably already have got that. Those of you who are starting out, some of you came here because maybe you already have that faith. Some of you are still testing it. I would say keep sitting and try to sit in the way that you were taught. Try to sit up straight. Keeping your attention on the heart as much as possible and count the breaths. Sometimes when my mind is really occupied with something else, I visualize the numbers down there on my belly, kind of like they were tattoos, sort of putting a visual component in my attention.
Do we have to visualize that too? I don't know. On your belly.
Red, white, and blue. And I have down here in my notes effort and energy. So I always found doing sit-ups very good too, because it helps strengthen your back. So if you're able to get some strength in the trunk of your body, that helps as well. Effort and energy probably come from the faith and the understanding that, hey, this is something that really can work for me. This is something that I want to do. Okay, then I went to the website and I found a bunch of hindrances to practice, or fetters, which I'm going to read here. Self-delusion. We kid ourselves in thinking what the world really is, rather than understanding what reality really is. Skeptical doubt. Sloth and torpor. Clinging to ritual. I sort of puzzled over that one, clinging to ritual. And I think that goes a long way, because, you know, our brains are very habitual. They can create habits almost instantaneously. And so we get used to doing things a certain way. When I was visiting Japan a couple of years ago, there was a McDonald's restaurant that I used to go to for breakfast. I didn't go to any other place, probably because McDonald's opened early and most other places didn't. But I kept going there because I felt comfortable there. Basically, I kind of created a habit of going there. And I was thinking, I should go some other places, because I'm a tourist and I should get to know other places. But I kept going back there. It was interesting. So it's very quick and very easy to create a ritual. And sometimes these rituals will take you away from the practice. Sensuous lust, which would be greed, among other things. Ill will and anger. Greed for fine material existence. Greed for immaterial existence. And when we're sitting zazen, one of the things that we would like to do is to give up our ego mind, a mind that's telling us that we're such a good person and all the rest of that, and just let that drop away for us. So if we have this greed for this existence, and it's kind of the ego saying, "Yeah, I want to be here, I want to be alive, I want to exist," and the ego wants to do it in this very special way, which I'll read about here in a minute. Maybe I should read about it right now. Let's see if I can find it. Ego in its worst state. Ego wants to live forever. It wants to be the center of the world, and it wants to put everything under his control. That was a wonderful, wonderful way to talk about the ego. So we have this greed for existence. We have this greed, basically, for this ego to do that stuff. Conceit. I can do it my way. I don't need to do that. Restlessness and worry. Ignorance. Okay, so those are some of the things which can keep us from practice. In my case, you know, over the last few months, I would say sloth and torpor is probably the thing that's been getting me the most. Maybe a little bit of conceit. I don't really know what's going on. And ignorance. Okay. I mean, ignorance is this idea that I'm going to live forever, and I'm the only one. I'm the guy. I'm permanent. And when we think that, we're ignorant, and it's really easy to slip into that mode. That's that ego coming after us. You know, ego deluding us into thinking we're it, and we're the only it. So, where to practice? I guess I'm doing the newspaper thing, you know, who, why, what, how, all that stuff. I learned that in eighth grade. Where to practice? Well, the Zendo here is a great place to practice. It's the nursery of practice, in a sense. You come here, you learn, you get the Zazen instruction, plus you have the community here to support you. It's amazing how when you come here and other people are sitting, it really energizes your sitting. It makes a big difference. So some people find that they can't really sit at home or other places, but they can sit here. So this is the place. And I wrote down your home because I do sit at home, and I have two places to sit, or have Zafu set up, one in my bedroom and one in the guest bedroom. So when the guests come, I take my stuff out, and the guests move in, I sit in my own bedroom. I also sit in bed I'll wake up in the middle of the night, I'll sit up, I'll put the pillow under my fanny, and I'll just sit there for a while. And then I wrote down here, all places, Zazen being a 24/7 activity. So, you know, where this idea of mindfulness, where we are, we're constantly meeting the world, and we are meeting that world in a mindful way. That is Zazen in its big picture. That's practice in its big picture. And then I wrote down here, camping in Tuolumne Meadows. I have this little story I wanted to tell. Many years ago, when my kids were young, my wife and my kids and I were camping in Tuolumne Meadows in Yosemite. And you know, Yosemite has a bear problem. We trained the bears in the 30s, 40s, and 50s to eat human food. There was a big garbage pit. I remember in the 50s, my parents took me to Yosemite Valley. And there was a garbage pit there. And in the evenings, we would go over and watch the bears go over, you know, and paw through the garbage pit. So we trained them, and we enjoyed training them. It was great. It's a great event. And now, of course, we say, these bears are a real problem for us. So the bears come around the campsites. And I was meditating on the picnic table, on the bench, sitting out. It was about 11 o'clock at night. And in Tuolumne Meadows, there are no electric lights. So when it's dark, any light you get comes from your flashlight or the stars or the moon or whatever. It was quite dark that night. So I was sitting. My kids and my wife had gone to bed. And suddenly I saw this shadow about 2 feet away from me. It was a bear snuffling up. And I saw it. It didn't know I was there until I moved. But I saw this sort of shadow in the corner of my eye. I saw it, and I just jumped out. And the funny thing is, the bear jumped the other way. So there's lots of opportunities to sit, a lot of different places to sit. In the mountains and rivers, Sishin, everyone sits on their on whatever they have. I think this last time they were out on the beach. Facing the ocean, it was coming in. There's people saying it was really neat. They liked that a lot. Okay, when to practice? Well, there's a schedule here in the Zendo, and we have the morning and afternoon practice, and daily. And as I said, when I first started practicing, I came both in the morning and in the afternoon, and that was great. And when I was Shuso back in 2000. If you saw sitting over in that seat there, I came every period for the 5 weeks that the practice period was then, both morning and evening. That was really nice. Boy, if you said both morning and evening, maybe some of you do that. It's really a very really your ego managed to sort of find its own place, if you will, not taking the ascendancy. It sort of finds its own place and doesn't become as quite as bothersome. It's very comfortable. Also, in the Zen Center here, we have our periodic one-day and multi-day sittings and sesshins, which, as I said earlier, are really great. You sit a seven-day sesshin, it's really six and a half, 7 days, and you sit every period, or almost every period. Your legs start hurting, your body, you get tired because you're getting up early and going to bed late. But if you stick with that and put that energy and effort into it, you really begin to understand what it means when I talk about body and mind falling away. Because you start putting away the things, I want this, I want that, and you just let yourself be there. And that's very nice. And then that experience you can then carry forward into places like when you're in traffic and you're trying to wait and your patience is getting tried, you can just be there. Put your attention down here. Sojourn always says when you're out in the world or here as well, always keep a little bit of your attention on your breathing and your attention down here in your hara. So you learn how to do that. And I found this coming to the Zen Center easier for me when I was working full time. I had to be there at work at around 8 o'clock in the morning, so I had to get up, so I had to go to bed. So I just got up a little bit earlier and came to the Zendo. Or got up a little bit earlier and sat in my own house. And now that I'm semi-retired, and I work at home, I don't really have a set schedule. I don't have a boss telling me to get up. And matter of fact, the guy that I work for waits. He called me on the phone and said, "You awake?" So he waits for me to wake up, if you will, before he puts me to work. And I'm only working maybe 10 to 20 hours a week, so it's not a big deal for me. But the fact that I don't have this schedule, this formal schedule that's being imposed on me from the outside, means I have to find that formal schedule from the inside. And that is it's not easy for me. That's an area where I need work. I need energy. And I know the key is going to bed early. And so I say, okay, 9 o'clock, I'm going to take my shower and go to bed. And 9 o'clock rolls around, I find myself doing something else. Reading, really interesting stuff. But I just kind of just put that off. And when I finally do get to bed, it takes me a while to get to sleep. I have I'm a night person anyway. So for me, I'm just as happy not going to bed until 2 o'clock in the morning. That would be great from my viewpoint. Sujin and I were talking about that, and he said, yeah, he's not a morning person either, although it's hard to believe because he's here all the time. But this is where I need some discipline, and I know it, and somewhere I hope I will find it so I can get here more. Monday mornings are especially nice to be here at the Zen Center because we have a student talk 3 Mondays a month. And then on the other Monday, we have a discussion. So it's really a way to get to know the Sangha and get to know the people in it and what the issues and ideas are that are floating through the Sangha. So it's really a nice time to come. Okay, and a lot of people come on Monday that don't come other days. Or we have a big turnout on Monday mornings. Okay. So now I come to the hard part. Or maybe not the hard part. But why practice? Why do we practice? So the new people, why did they come here to the Zen Center today to get Zazen instruction? What did they hear? What do they think that's going to happen? And why do I practice, who've been practicing for 30 plus years, seen a lot of different practice experiences and whatnot, why do I keep practicing? And as you can hear, why do I want to continue practicing and even practice more than I'm doing? That's a good question. So, wrote down here, health. Some of us come to the Zen Center for health reasons. We went to stress reduction, heart attack recovery, lower the blood pressure, maybe cancer control. There's other reasons too, I'm sure healthy reasons. I know one woman who came here, her doctor told her to meditate, so she came here to the Berkeley Zen Center just so she could learn how to meditate to manage her heart condition. And she realized that there was more to Zen than just that, more to meditation than just health reduction or health improvement. which is good. But if you just come here for health, that's good too. That's great. And then I wrote down here enlightenment. So when I was, when I first started out, I kind of thought that enlightenment sounded really good. Kensho experience. When you read the books about Kensho experiences, and it sounds like really a cool high. And so I sort of thought of it as sort of like a legal high. You get high, and you don't have to worry about being rousted. And I understand that the ancients tried drugs and as an alternative to serious practice, and decided, as I agree with, that it doesn't work. It's totally different. You take drugs or alcohol, and your brain just isn't clear. One time I was sitting, so we were starting a sesshin. I think it was the second day, and this guy said, "Well, here, take some aspirin, or I think it was ibuprofen, to help the pain." And I said, "Oh, okay, I'll do that." So I took some ibuprofen, and I couldn't really sit for the rest of the day. There was something about the medicine that affected my brain, and I couldn't concentrate. I couldn't really get into it. It's kind of like I was, there was a screen between me and the rest of the world and my zazen. So I didn't do that after that anymore. And I think that's the way drugs are. They kind of, they may feel good, but there's also a screen between you and the rest of the world, which I don't like. Okay, so, but enlightenment is something we'll talk about some more. Then there's the Bodhisattva's great truths, his four great truths, talking about suffering and the elimination of suffering. I wrote down here, agitation, dissatisfaction. That's the first truth. You know, basically we have agitation, we have dissatisfaction. We know it's this. That's there. Some people say life is suffering. I don't like to say that. I say in life there is suffering, and it's almost inherent in our the fact that we are alive. We're always going to need to eat as long as we're alive, and so if we don't get food, there's going to be some suffering, some pain, some agitation with that. But I don't want to say life itself is suffering. I don't think that's true. I think life is a lot of fun. Okay, so the second truth is desire is the cause of this suffering. And if we want a girlfriend, and we see someone who might be a candidate to be a girlfriend, and we don't make it, then we're really unhappy. Back years ago, when I was in high school, my girlfriend broke up with me. I was really, ruined my whole summer. I'm not a happy camper. because I really wanted her to be my girlfriend. I really liked her. So that's just a couple of examples. And, these examples are rampant. And you all, probably all of you are familiar with them. Desire can cease. That's the third truth. Buddha realized, we can end this desire we can end the suffering by ending our desire. And then the fourth truth, of course, of the Eightfold Path, how we live our lives in a way that that minimizes our desire and minimizes our suffering. One of the things that we learn in the sesshin, when our legs are hurting, is that we don't like the hurt. We just don't like it, and we have a battle with ourselves. We have a war that says, "I don't like this. I can't move. I don't like this. I can't move." And so there's this constant crashing between. This rules you set for yourself, not moving and not liking the desire. This creates a tremendous amount of suffering. And this is kind of where the breakthrough is, because then you should say, okay, I'm just going to put that all away. I'm just going to drop this war. I'm just going to accept whatever this is. And so while the pain is still there, the suffering goes away, because you say, okay, I'm just going to accept that pain. And actually, pain is interesting because that comes and goes. So sometimes it's not there, and then it comes back, and it kind of goes and whatnot. So that's one of the great things that I learned in the sesshin is just that, how to look at that pain, not in a way that says, I don't like this, I want to move, I want to get away from it, to, oh, there's that pain. Oh, there it is. Okay. So how much time do I have?
It's 6 after, so a few minutes for questions.
A few minutes for questions. Right. Okay, I'll go through this. So I talked about practicing to give up the self-centeredness of the ego. And I tell you about what the ego was. Live forever, center of the world, put everything under its control. But we can't live without the ego. We're stuck with it. It's there for us, for our lives. And we're still going to have these bodily needs, food, sleep, sex, so on and so forth. So what we learn in Zazen is where that ego fits in the natural order of ourselves. So, let me read this last part here. In Zazen, we also meet our true selves, and we learn that the true self is possible without ego activity. True self is a life lived with the true self active and the ego subservient to it. for a long time I thought that Zen practice was just sitting Zazen and usually in the Zendo. I did. That's sort of like there's this discontinuity between practice and the rest of my life. But as I matured, I learned that my practice, really, the most important part of my practice is how I'm meeting the world every day, in every moment. So I guess I'll stop at that point and open it for questions, if anybody has a question. I've covered everything, so there shouldn't be any questions. Yes?
Well, since you've covered everything, I won't ask anything, but I did want to say, I think that this might be the first time I've heard you talk.
Hmm.
Or maybe I heard you talk sometime in the first couple of years when I didn't hear anything anyway. But I just really appreciated the way you talked. It was very just regular language. There wasn't a whole lot of Zen speak that I get lost, and I just really appreciated the way you talk. It made me start thinking about a whole lot of things that I hadn't thought about, and maybe helped me understand things that, you know, for the past 8 years I haven't really understood. Oh, that's what that means. So thanks, Richard. I really appreciate that.
Thank you. Appreciate that. That's why I'm here. Yes.
Struggle with that idea, and you gave us in your why section, you gave some wonderful reasons, and your whole talk was about your own desire and love practice and what it does for you, and you spoke about whether it works or not. So how do you put together that with the idea that now sometimes says, well, just don't come to the end of it, get something or calm down. If you think you're going to get something, then you're not going to get it.
Mm-hmm.
Just stop and sit with something.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, sometimes I don't listen to Mel. I'm sure he's right. And I think that when you read Dogen, when you read Suzuki Roshi or listen, that's what practice really is just this following away of body and mind. But again, we live with our egos, and so our egos are going to come, and they're going to say, boy, I really want to go to Zazen today because I'm going to feel good afterward. Sometimes you don't feel good afterward and say, oh, I'm disappointed. And sometimes people, I think newer people, don't get what they think they're going to get. And which is kind of a shame, because when you stick with it, you start getting it, if you will. You know, there's this, the sixth patriarch, there was this war between the sixth patriarch, was a young man, and another Zen student, about who had the right understanding. And the Zen student said something like, your mind is like a mirror, you have to keep it clean. The mirror reflecting reality. You have to keep it clean from delusion. And the sixth patriarch said, well, really, from the very beginning there's no mirror, so what is there to clean? And, you know, both of those are true. That's my understanding. We have to, it's true that there's nothing to gain, there's nothing to get from Zazen, because there was nothing from the beginning to get. But on the other hand, we do have, my mind still wants to program computers, or my mind still, when somebody cuts me off in traffic, still gets angry at that person. And my brain rings with that, delusion, that ego stuff, and I sit in part to dampen that ringing. Yeah.
Sorry. Going back to what you started the talk on, you said you up and down, and you're in a down period, and I'm thinking that this no gaining mind, this period where you feel sort of uninspired, all the things that were getting you all charged up to practice seem a little bit weak and there's no reason to practice, or maybe that's a really good time.
To practice?
Yeah.
Right. Right. There's that's a trouble with having gaining the idea. We think when we gained it, oh, I don't need to do this anymore. Yeah. I've been there. It didn't work anymore. I think we're out of time.
Here we are.
Mary?
I'm with Dean. Thank you very much for your talk. I think this is related to Susan's question, which I was struck by the tension between the image at the very beginning that you had of resting or relief, and that almost melting is the moment, and the energy of effort about meeting every moment in, you know, the tension between the effort and the, you said, I think, even relaxing. And I don't know where to go with that.
Well, I'm still, I still don't consider myself a finished Zen student. So we'll work on that together. Thank you.